Well, when I guess my talk will be more of an old-fashioned talk than the one that you've just observed. And when Ellen asked me to review or give a talk on interplanetary turbulence, and I started thinking seriously about what to do, I realized that there was no way that I could do a thorough review of it, even if I was as good with a laptop computer as Mr. Berger. And it might not even be appropriate for those of you who are really interested in the details of interplanetary turbulence. There are some excellent references. For example, Chen Yi Tu and Eckhart Marsh have a 210-page review article in the Space Science Reviews. And, of course, I got that article. Well, in fact, I have had it for a long time, and I keep it with me. And I went through it, and I thought, oh, my God, it's just densely packed. So then there's the question of, what is turbulence? Now, I grew up in the atmosphere at UC San Diego, where Hannes Alfvén appeared in the summer like a giant vulture and settled in. And if you said the word turbulence in front of Hannes Alfvén, he would give you a one-hour lecture on why the solar wind wasn't turbulent. And of course, it made giving seminars real easy. If you wanted Hans to give the seminar, you just said turbulence at the start, and there would be no more you needed to say. So, then I should tell you what I'm interested in, and then you'll see my viewpoint in it. I'm a radio astronomer, and I've spent a lot of time remote sensing the solar wind, particularly turbulence of it. But my interest is in the energy flow. I'd like to know what accelerates the solar wind and how what we call turbulence contributes to the heating of the corona and the acceleration of the solar wind, rather than turbulence per se, which of course is an interesting topic on its own. And so if you realize that that's my slant, then I don't really care whether my definition of turbulence agrees with Carl's Gibson's version or anybody else's. What we have in the solar wind are fluctuations, there is evidence for energy input from large-scale shear flows that is ultimately dissipated by some unknown mechanism, and I'd like to be able to estimate the amount of power that's dissipated in there. I think that there's no evidence for turbulence in the classic neutral turbulence mode, that where it's dominated by vorticity and there's a vorticity cascade that may proceed from small scales to large scales. And astrophysicists often pass through a lot of detail and simply think of it as a cascade from large to small scales, which is really greatly oversimplifying even the neutral turbulence case, let alone the MHD turbulence. So, since excuse the introduction, but I thought since I don't know two-thirds of the audience, then you probably don't know me either, and it seemed like a good idea to get the viewpoints right. At first glance, the solar wind seems like a good laboratory for studying astrophysical turbulence. It's nearby. We can make a lot of direct measurements. We can make great indirect measurements on it. It's just a whole lot easier to study than the interstellar medium, for example. And furthermore, to an astronomer, it seems pretty simple. And what you have is essentially a point source, spherical outflow, supersonic plasma, and terminating in a termination shock when the ram pressure balances the interstellar medium pressure. Well, it ought to be a great laboratory. But when you look at it more closely, you realize that it's a highly structured flow. The fluctuations in the plasma magnetic field parameters are certainly caused by a large combination of things. There's certainly a flux of outgoing Alphane waves that carries a lot of energy, although probably not enough energy to accelerate the solar wind. There is probably some MHD turbulence in the Kraepelin sense. There's evidence for nonlinear interactions between Alphane waves. And there's a very significant component of static pressure balance structures, or perhaps you could think of them as entropy structures that are moving out with the flow. So it's by no means simple MHD turbulence. So I thought that since the audience would not all be familiar with the corona and the solar wind, that I would try to make it clear, you know, what these structures are and how they complicate trying to understand the turbulence. And furthermore, after 40 years of measurements of the solar wind, both directly and indirectly, a lot of excellent theoretical work, we still don't understand what heats the corona in the first place, or what causes the solar wind velocity to be what it is in a quantitative sense. That is, we have a theory that gets it within a factor of two. That's not very good. So my plan is to quickly show a few pictures of the corona to remind you what the structure is down there, and then show some direct measurements of the plasma properties in the solar wind, just to illustrate the complexity of the observed flow. And then I wanted to say a few words about solar wind acceleration theory and how that would relate to turbulence and waves and dissipation and what energy we need for that. I'll show some direct measurements of plasma and field fluctuations. And finally, I'll get to my own interests, which is the indirect measurements and where they can probe regions that are much more active. Basically, we have only directly measured, of course, into where we've had spacecraft, which is a Mercury's orbit. And all of the action that I consider interesting is in very much closer to the sun. So we can do some nice things with indirect measurements that you can't do with spacecraft. And I guess I should outline why. Spacecraft basically make very detailed measurements at a point, and the solar wind flows past it. That means you've got a one-dimensional cut in the direction of the velocity, and you really can't separate out space-time effects unless you have a very simple pattern. Whereas with indirect measurements, you can make images, and so you can get a two-dimensional picture and for example, measure spatial anisotropies. Okay, so first some nice pictures. Now, the best pictures of the corona are still taken at eclipses, so why not have an eclipse picture? That's a typical solar minimum eclipse picture, and it shows the fact that the solar wind over the poles, there on obviously the top, is quite different from the equatorial region during the activity minimum. And if you look carefully, you'll see that even, actually it's particularly obvious in the north section, even in the apparently unstructured north polar stream, there are some faint radial structures or quasi-radial structures that bend outwards a little bit, which are called polar plumes. Thanks. And of course you can contrast that with the solar maximum view, which is certainly not isotropic and homogeneous, but at least it's latitude invariant, where you have all of these structures which are referred to as helmet structures. Does this thing extend? It's a laser.
Oh,
hey. Well, so I am modern, right? Well, every kid has one on his keychain now. Okay, so it's assumed that these, in fact, delineate magnetic field lines, and that what you have, for example, here is a magnetic field loop, and in fact under here and all of the other ones, and then you have open magnetic field lines that go out forming the cusp of the helmet. And as I say, the nice thing about eclipse pictures is that they get you right down to the limb of the sun. Now, as you go further out, the SOHO white light coronagraphs are really wonderful. They're just marvelous. And to remind you that this is a false color image. And I guess the reason it's orange is because everybody in works in the solar wind knows that orange stands for the C2 coronagraph. But actually, it's a white light image. And in white light, you're seeing photons, Thomson scattered off of electrons. So it's essentially an electron density image. Okay, so it's pure density. And this is taken at solar minimum. And you can see that as you've gone further out, this north polar hole has expanded. Both of the polar holes have expanded. And you can also see a little bit of a loop-like region here. This is, again, it's assumed that those are magnetic loops because you would expect, of course, the flow to go along the magnetic field, because inside of about 3 solar radii, magnetic energy density dominates the kinetic energy density. This is, in fact, an outwards moving disturbance called a coronal mass ejection, although it's not a great example of one. With the same instrument at solar maximum. No, the loops and CMEs are in fact magnetics, and shocks will form in front of them if they're moving faster than the flow by the Alfvén speed. That one wasn't. Okay. So at solar maximum, you see, as you get further out, these things remain rather sharp-edged, and those sharp filamentary things proceed out quite a ways. In fact, some of them, quite interestingly, are rather straight, but obviously don't extrapolate back to the center of the sun. So there's some non-radial flow persisting out quite a distance. And from my point of view, even more interesting is the C2 coronagraph. C3, sorry, which goes out to 30 solar radii and provides good contrast and resolution way out, and it's fairly easy to make radio measurements out in this region. Radio measurements inside here are less common because we don't have sources behind the sun that often, but we can almost always find them out at 10 solar radii. And so you see these things have sort of necked down, and continue on out to at least 20 solar radii before they become more diffuse. This is the pylon that supports the occulting disk. And another one at solar minimum. This one happened to be one where we were taking an observation in this region, which is why the little circle is here. But the reason for showing it is because it shows a very nice example of a coronal mass ejection. Now, coronal mass ejection just adds to the complexity, but it's a loop, or probably a rope of magnetic field, that lifts off, apparently buoyant in the flow, and it does not necessarily go out faster than the flow velocity. Sometimes they do. When they do, they create a shock in front of them. But often they just seem to be dragged out and caught up in the ambient flow. And so if you're measuring out in the solar wind, you have to be able to sort these things out. Now, one of the interesting features of the corona is how few photospheric observations seem to correlate with them at all. There are wonderful photospheric observations, and when you compare them with the coronagraph observations, you just don't see any comparison at all. These things that are very obvious in the corona don't show up in the photosphere. Now, this is a Yoko soft X-ray telescope observation, and this is in fact the only sort of lower sun observation that does show any corona, any correlation. These dark regions, particularly near the poles, were first identified in soft X-rays, and they're regions that are, well, they're obviously cool in X-ray, and they have been correlated with fast wind, low electron temperature, and open magnetic field lines. Although why that correlation should be so is sort of less obvious, because the soft X-ray telescope is sensitive to temperatures of the order of 10 to the 7th K. Oh, sorry, 7 times 10 to the 6th, say. Whereas the kinetic temperature is more like a million. So it's a very high energy tail that shows up this correlation, not what you'd expect, you know, the bulk temperature. But the correlation was very nicely done by some people at HAO, so I stole their picture off the web. There's a Yoko image with a white light coronagraph image over the top, and you can see that this coronal hole, particularly in the south, just stands out beautifully, which is typical of the highly diverging magnetic field structures that give rise to these polar holes at solar minimum, but not at solar maximum. So that's a very quick picture show of the corona. Now, further out in the solar wind, we can measure the solar wind velocity with the radio scattering methods. And my colleagues at Nagoya have prepared some nice pictures of velocity in the equal area projection. So if we look at, let's pick 1985, for example. This is basically ecliptic longitude, latitude, equal area projection, where the scale is blue is fast and red is slow, and fast is 700 or 800 kilometers per second and slow is 300. So you see in 85, 86, and 87 a slow wind belt around the equator. Those were the years of solar minimum. 84, well, in fact, 83 and 84 were in the declining phase. And you see that there is a slow wind belt, but it's quite irregular. And in fact, at times it can be modeled by a tilted pattern, as if the slow wind belt was modeled as the as a magnetic equatorial zone rather than a rotational pole. Then as the solar activity increases, it broadens out and eventually covers 4π steradians, and then slowly fast wind starts to creep in again around the poles. And these measurements are characteristic of about half an AU. Okay. And the velocity is sensibly constant from, say, 20 solar radii on out. So we have to bear in mind very strong solar cycle effects in the solar wind. Then if you look directly with the best source of information is the Ulysses spacecraft, and you can get these off the web, and they even format them nicely once you figure out how to operate the web interface. In fact, I'll put the web addresses and some references in my I'll give it to the organizers so that if you need to pick them up, you can get them. Giving you web things in real time hardly useful. Okay, this was that's the magnitude of the magnetic field, the flow velocity, the density, and the temperature of the protons. At this time, Ulysses was pretty much at the peak northern latitude, and then it latitude decreased, and around this point it had dropped to around about 30 degrees latitude, and then first started to see the slow wind belt. Now at that time the slow wind belt was a little bit tilted with respect to the rotational equator. So as the sun rotated, Ulysses would pick up the slow wind belt when it reached its most northerly latitude, and then would go back into the fast wind belt. So you would see the velocity drop in this characteristic way every 27 days, and the magnetic field magnitude would burst up, of course, and you can see the other correlated parameters. Then as Ulysses continued to drop, it went into continuous slow wind, and you see that there's quite a difference in the character of the density and the magnetic field in those regions. I mean, more than striking. In the fast wind region, you would say that looks like a Gaussian process. And over here you'd say that looks pretty wild, chaotic. So I expanded up taking 4 months of data in the high-speed wind, and you can see that even when you blow it up, it still looks pretty Gaussian, relatively small variations. That's only 700 to 860 kilometers per second, so the scale has been expanded quite a bit, and the zero has been taken off the B magnitude, so again, the fluctuation amplitudes are relatively small. The density fluctuations are really small, and again, the temperature is relatively homogeneous. So the fast wind looks like a good candidate to try to analyze if you're trying to do things simply. Whereas a similar chunk, 4 days out in the slow wind, is dominated by very pronounced structures, even on, well, so say this is 4 months, so these structures are recurring every rotation. And this thing is a co-rotating interaction region which has developed into a shock. That's a forward shock. The trailing edge of that magnetic thing is not a shock, or not a reverse shock, although it might have been when it was a little closer to the sun. Typically, you get a forward reverse shock pair forming with a magnetic compression between them. But as you go further out, the shocks will decay into waves. Yeah.
Is that one component
of the field? That's the magnitude. Unfortunately, that was the largest I could get the letters to. If you blow the shock up, just to see how nice it can be, you see the sort of thing that you expect, very sharp, discontinuous changes in the magnetic field, the velocity and the density, and the temperature. You also see an interesting phenomenon here that the density drops almost to zero there. What's happening there is that basically the fast wind is running away from the slow wind, and this is the source of most of that structure. As the sun rotates and a fast bit of wind rotates underneath where there had been slow wind before, fast wind catches up with the slow wind, and it's, if the velocity difference is large enough, basically the gradient gets high enough, it will form a shock. But of course, there will also be places where the fast wind is running away from the slow wind, and there the density can drop extremely low. But of course, not a shock forming there. So there's the idea of this was to convince you that the solar wind is perhaps not a simple model that one would want to apply to other astrophysical plasmas. That doesn't mean it isn't interesting, but one should obviously use a good deal of caution in interpreting solar wind measurements. And I suppose one could extrapolate that caution to such things as the interstellar medium, which we don't know as well, but could certainly expect to have equivalent complexity. So a few things about solar wind acceleration theory, which I don't have any slides of, but I hope that everybody is aware of Gene Parker's MHD acceleration model. It has every feature one could desire in a theory. Gene proposed it before it was measured. It was extremely controversial, and he was called all sorts of nasty things. and it was essentially right. and it's mathematically simple and beautiful. I mean, what more could you have? I mean, it's so beautiful and elegant that it must be right. And essentially, the idea is if you write the MHD, you know, conservation equations for mass flux and momentum and energy, and you use the boundary conditions of a million degree temperature, the solar wind, and at the coronal base and zero pressure at infinity, you get a supersonic transition point, which is actually fairly close to the sun, perhaps five solar radii or so. and then a flow that starts and goes through the transition point and on. And once you know that, then it's relatively easy to come up with a hand-waving or even a mathematical sort of exospheric view, which is basically that a million degree electrons, their kinetic velocity exceeds the escape speed. So these things escape. And that sets up an ambipolar field that drags out the protons. And that's often a useful picture intuitively, because the MHD picture is a little harder for most of us to visualize. The only problem with the either of those pictures is that when you put the numbers in, a million degree corona will only support a final terminal velocity of about 300 kilometers per second, and the terminal velocity in the region that ought to apply to best, that is in the open diverging field regions, is about 800 kilometers per second. So we're not getting enough energy in. And you could say, well, maybe we're wrong in the base temperature measurements. They're hard to make, and there is a substantial uncertainty. But what happens if you increase the temperature, electron temperature in the coronal base? Primarily what you do is promote more electrons above the escape speed, and so the mass flux goes way up. The velocity goes up too, but the mass flux goes far above what's observed. So even if the temperature observations were wrong, you know, getting a higher temperature doesn't do the job. You need to somehow add energy or momentum to the wind after the sonic point in order to get the velocity up without increasing the mass flux. Because the mass flux that Parker predicted is about right. And of course, that's why I'm interested in turbulence, because of the possibility that turbulent damping after the sonic point is adding that extra energy to the solar wind, and thereby increasing the terminal velocity to what we'd see. And as I say, you ought to expect that to work better in the fast wind, because the fast wind is at least more similar to a spherical flow than the slow wind, which is dominated by these closed structures and incredibly complicated things. So that's that gave rise to a cottage industry of people who proposed outflow of Alphane waves and ran a lot of models on what amounts to basically using the ponderomotive force of outwards flowing Alphane waves to add energy to the solar wind. And in fact, you could do it quite nicely. But relatively recently, we realized that wasn't going to work, because It's a relatively slow process. The ponderable motor force works over a long scale, and even if you used an unknown nonlinear damping mechanism, heating it in an extended way doesn't raise the solar wind velocity very fast. And it's now known that the velocity is essentially constant into about 10 solar radii. And so we need to get the energy in faster than you can do it by simply basically an energy gradient argument. So we need to look more carefully at damping. Now, in the meantime, we've also got some evidence that the proton temperature may be substantially higher than the electron temperature. Proton temperature is really hard to measure, because you have to use resonance lines, and you can use Lyman alpha or other resonance lines. But they're broad and hard to measure, and confused by large-scale velocity variations, too. But it could be that the proton temperature is as high as 5 million degrees and the electron temperature is only a million. That still doesn't get the proton velocity up that high, but at least it makes it easier for the electrons to drag them out, and so you can get a somewhat higher flow speed. But then, of course, you'd have to ask, well, why are the protons hotter than the electrons? And the thing that pops into everybody's mind is cyclotron damping. And so then you're back to waves and damping. And are those waves, well, where do the waves come from? Oh, they come from basically these convective motions that we saw so beautifully this morning. And how do we get them to the high frequencies where they ought to damp? Well, we need a nonlinear cascade, right? We need turbulence. On the other hand, life is a little more complicated because to get interaction between MHD waves, you need them going both ways. And it's not easy to see what the source of inwards flowing Elfbane waves is in the high-speed wind. On the slow-speed wind, there's no problem because all those structures, co-rotating interaction regions and so on, cause local generation of waves, which are going both inwards and outwards, so you can mix beautifully there. But fast wind, it's not so obvious. Pardon?
Why do waves have to go in the opposite direction?
Now, this is where my weakness as a theoretician just shows up completely. You know, apparently you do need that. Two waves going in the same direction just don't couple as strongly.
Well, they generate a deep wave, which prevents the ion.
Yeah. Pardon? The plasma beta is unity around three or four solar radii, and it had been thought that it got small inside rather rapidly, but now we think the protons are hotter than we used to think, so it may hover around unity for quite a ways, and it gets high as you go further out. Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah. You can get other mixing operations. So
you don't need
Oh, yeah. Well, you see, there isn't all that much compression in the. Well, there's no compression associated with completely radially propagating outwards waves, right? Well, delta B over B is pretty small. Delta V over delta VA probably gets to one at the orbit of the Earth. And it increases almost linearly with distance. So when you're in this acceleration region, it's really small. Yeah. No. T perp is higher than T parallel, and that's another reason why people suggest that. Right. The the protons do not cool as fast as you would expect adiabatically. So there's a substantial amount of transfer to the protons, and it's not Coulomb collisions. No. Essentially, the solar wind is collisionless, and so you have to assume an anomalous resistivity of some sort. Yeah. Well, sure, but of course there's lots of wave-wave interactions which produce essentially that same thing. Let me show one graph from Tu and Marsh that summarizes things in a nice way. That they've used the Elsasser variables to separate out inwards and outwards flowing waves, and plotted the power spectrum. So we see in the left side measurements at 0.4 and 0.8 AU in the high-speed wind, 0.4 and 0.9 AU in the low-speed wind, of the E minus Elsasser variable, which is the inwards propagating one. And those are not corrected for distance. Those are absolute levels, which are all, interestingly, about the same, although it's believed that this flattening is real. Whereas in the outwards propagating Elsasser variable, in high and low, and this is also low by that error in the original paper. so you see that it's not. This is a Kolmogorov slope, by the way. The outwards propagating spectrum is substantially flatter and higher, and it drops faster with distance at high frequencies than it does at low frequencies. So you could ask, how does it change with distance at low frequencies? At low frequencies, which basically dominate the integral, it goes according to the WKB approximation, basically adiabatic, except for the energy that you give up to the Pondermotive force. But at high frequencies, it's dropping faster than that, and Tu and Marsh consider that to be a prima facie argument that there is some nonlinear interaction. On the other hand, it's not quite the direction I would have expected a nonlinear interaction. But there is. These are relatively low frequencies. Damping by cyclotron interaction would occur about three orders of magnitude higher. So to get those damped, you've got to exchange the energy all the way down to here somewhere. Now, I won't have time to go through the remote sensing observations, and it's not necessary to do that. I'll simply point out that near the sun, the observations show that the remote sensing observations can only show the density structure. Let me give you another plot of that. An Elsasser variable, but if I can, I have a plot of delta B over B. I'm going to stop right now anyway. So in delta B over B increases from perhaps a tenth at 20 solar radii to one at 200 solar radii. And the observations that we saw there were at about 60 solar radii. So delta B over B was maybe a half to a third. There's no doubt that there's Landau damping as soon as you have compressional waves. Oh, okay. I was thinking of linear Landau damping. Yeah. Right. Well, let me just say a few words about the density spectrum, because of course this is important from the point of view of remote sensing of things that are further out. It's just very difficult to get a handle on magnetic fields and velocities in a spectral sense, whereas with radio scattering measurements you can measure density. Well, the density spectra don't look like the magnetic field spectrum. They start Kolmogorov at low frequencies, and then at high frequencies they flatten out a little bit. And in this high frequency region they're very anisotropic, whereas in the lower frequency region they're isotropic. So it would appear then that what you have is what many of us would call a turbulence spectrum here, if it's not classical turbulence, and what you may have here is an additional wave mode, which is added on top of everything else, and that wave mode is anisotropic. Now, that could account for the heating of the solar wind, and in fact the necessary dissipation mechanism, although we haven't been able to fit it all together yet, but the idea would be that outwards propagating shear Alfvén waves scatter into obliquely propagating waves because they're going through filamentary structures and they get phase modulated, and that effect is that they go out to an angle. Now, obliquely propagating Alfvén waves, as they get out, now we're talking about the cyclotron branch, they get compressive as they go to higher frequencies and higher angles, and those compressive waves land out damp, and if they get enough energy flow through, they'll also cyclotron damp. But the Landau damping comes in first. And in fact, if you don't invoke a cascade process, then the Landau damping will eat all the energy. But if you invoke a cascade, you can push enough energy through it that it'll go out and cyclotron damp. And we assume that cyclotron damping is necessary because we see T perp higher than T parallel. I don't expect to everybody to remember the details. And what I'd like to leave you with is a realization that after 40 years of hard work on a relatively nearby astrophysical plasma, we still don't understand the fundamentals of this thing. We got a lot of interesting ideas. Thank you.
Hi, Carl Gibson. I am absolutely fascinated by those Kolmogorovian spectra. Have you backed out from the velocity one what the indicated viscous dissipation rate would be? The last one you showed, that would be a Poisson-Obukhov type spectrum, and there would be another set of bachelor tail on the end.
People have attempted to get dissipation rates from those. And it has not been a very happy process. For one thing, the energy exchange rate wasn't high enough to accelerate the solar wind. And for another thing, it didn't all fit together in a nice model anyway. But I don't have the details. It doesn't provide the energy we'd like. But of course, it may be that these observations are too far out. See, the solar wind is already fully accelerated by 60 solar radii. We have to make those observations inside of 10 solar radii. And of course, this solar probe spacecraft NASA should have done it, 20 years ago. They're really stupid.
What radii?
Everywhere we can measure. Let's see. It doesn't seem to change a whole lot with distance, but it does decrease a little bit with distance. It's more prominent at Mercury's orbit, 60 solar radii. And it could be quite a bit higher, close to the Sun.
Isn't that contrary to what the Asiatic variant would say, is the particles should lose their particular energy, they're gone.
Yeah.
And without collision, you should see two parallel nearby, you should see
Yeah. It is contrary to, you know, the so-called rugged invariance. Something was going on. But you would expect the T-perp to continue to increase. Oh, yeah, but there's just a whole lot of stuff about the heavier ions that we don't understand. Heavier ions appear to be, all of the heavy ions, including the alphas, seem to be moving at an alphane speed with respect to the flow. They're surfing on alphane waves, and the temperature measurements of the heavy ions appear to almost be proportional to mass. It's obviously a very complex story.